is NPR, National Public Radio.
And this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. You're listening to Fresh Air, and it's now 3 minutes after 4 o'clock. We hear Jazz Revisited every Tuesday at 3:30, and this week's was a rebroadcast because of technical problems with this week's edition. With me now on Fresh Air is financial writer Andrew Tobias. He's written a new book on the insurance industry. It's called The Invisible Bankers, Everything the Insurance Industry Never Wanted You to Know. Tobias knows that although nearly everyone owns at least one kind of insurance, most of us don't associate the subject of insurance with the most exciting subject. But Tobias thinks the story of the insurance industry is fascinating. He says they just want us to think it's boring. Some of the facts he's uncovered include that State Farm has a larger capital base than the Bank of America, that the U.S., with only 5% of the world's people, accounts for 44.7% of total world premiums. ITT, which owns 25 insurance companies, makes more money from insurance than from communications. And Sears makes more money from its insurance company, Allstate, than from retail sales. The scope and power of the insurance industry is one of the reasons that Andrew Tobias finds the subject worthy of the 5 years he spent researching it. Tobias is the author of, in addition to this new book, The Only Investment Guide You'll Ever Need, and Getting By on $100,000 a Year and Other Sad Tales. He's a contributing editor to Esquire magazine, and his new book, The Invisible Bankers, is published by the Linden Press. Now, before we hear about insurance, we're going to start with a cliffhanger. And Andrew Tobias, let me welcome you and ask us to give us the beginning of this cliffhanger.
Okay. Well, this is one of a million sorts of things that happens because every insurance contract is an implied disaster or whatever. But here is this couple driving along the freeway. And this happened. I always change the names, but it really happened. They're driving along the freeway, and they get a flat tire. And the wife says to the husband, "Harry, change the tire." Harry says, "I'm not going to change the tire." She says, "Harry, change the tire." Harry says, "You know about my back. I'm not going to change the tire. We'll call AAA." They get madder and madder and madder. And she finally, and this is a true story, she pulls out a gun and she shoots him. And she kills this man dead. All right? Now, the question is, does she, the grieving widow who just murdered her husband because he wouldn't change the flat tire, does she or does she not collect the $22,000 of life insurance benefits that were in his policy? And I'm happy to either tell you now or later or any place you want.
No, this is the cliffhanger.
Oh, this is the cliffhanger? All right.
We'll get to, if the audience is good, we'll,
okay.
We'll get to this at the end of the show and find out if she collected or not.
Because this is the sort of stuff that applies to everyone. I mean, you need to know these things. You need to, how are you going to deal with a flat tire otherwise, right?
Right. Well, there's plenty of other claim stories where this one came from. I'd like to ask you to read the author's note that you open your book with.
Okay. So, no one, I've done lots of these shows now. This is a lovely request. No one's thought of it before. But I started the book with an author's note before the first chapter, and it says, "I believe in capitalism. I own stocks, even a few insurance company stocks. I believe in free enterprise and incentives, and by and large, in less government spending, less government regulation. I have vested interests. What's more, I have never personally suffered at the hands of an insurance company. I've never had a policy canceled for making a claim, never been harassed by an unscrupulous agent, never been fired, or employed for that matter, by an insurance company, never witnessed at close range anyone who was so victimized. Nor, indeed, am I desperate to stir up a little trouble and profit thereby. Eager, perhaps, but not desperate. I raise all this because to the not inconsiderable extent this book is critical of the insurance industry and its regulators, I hope it will not be taken, or dismissed, as the howlings of yet another anti-establishment liberal who doesn't understand what made this country great. I happen to believe that our howling anti-establishment liberals have themselves helped to make this country great, but on economic matters, at least, I am not one of them."
What did you find it necessary to write this disclaimer before the book?
Well, you know, especially with life insurance, every few years there is some attack. Starting in, I think, 1843, there was a book called Traps Baited with Orphan. Okay, and there was a book called like Thieves in the Night, and there have been all kinds of books about life insurance. Actually, there's never been one about the overall insurance industry before. Nonetheless, these books come and they go, and one of the reasons most of them never get anywhere, and most people they're dismissed so easily by the industry. This is an industry that, remind me to tell you what they did in the 19th century when the New York State Legislature did a whole hearing and how they laundered the record. But this is an industry that is impervious to most attack or most even constructive criticism. I like to think of my book as constructive criticism. And what they do To begin with, as they say, well, of course he's one of these left-wing types, don't you know, right? You know, he doesn't understand. He's one of these horrible consumerists. Now, the fact is, while I'm a great admirer of Ralph Nader and all that, and they have said nice things about the book, the fact is, I think sometimes consumerists go too far. I don't always agree with consumers. I really do own stocks. And the point is that the two things that make this book awkward for the insurance industry, if it is awkward, and it seems to be causing a little bit of awkwardness, first is it does really try very hard to have a sense of humor. Now, you may agree with Newsweek that the sense of humor is awful, you know, and all the stuff that they hated my lawyer jokes and all that. And some people are more or less offended by the tasteless footnotes and all that sort of thing. Nonetheless, there is such a predisposition among the consuming public to think it's boring and therefore not to learn about it and therefore to be paying hundreds of dollars a year more than they need to for their insurance coverage. There's such a predisposition towards that that I really tried to give it a sense of humor. Well, that's awkward for the industry because the easiest thing is no one ever looks at insurance. It's got to be that so complicated and dull. And the second thing was this aspect of it. I usually don't admit this, but I went to Harvard Business School, right? You know, I really do wear pinstripe suits. It's not an act. I mean, I don't wear them all the time, but and I think insurance is a great thing as such. And I think capitalism is a great thing. So this makes it a little harder for the industry to just slough off the book.
Well, you say that people assume that that insurance is either too hard to understand or too boring to penetrate. But you quote New York's insurance superintendent from 1969, and he was speaking to industry executives, and he said, you quote him, "Isolation is comfortable. How satisfying to be sure that no one understands us but ourselves." Do you think that they intentionally want to give the image of being boring to prevent us from reading
No,
them?
No. I use this line that they just want us to think it's boring, and some very literal-minded critics of mine have said, we don't want to be thought of as boring, and we want to be as interesting as everybody else. I said, hey, fellas, that's not what I mean. Forgive me if you're taking it that literally. What I mean is, nothing plays more into the hands of the industry than people thinking, hey, it's so boring, why should I compare prices or how could I ever fathom this? It turns out it's very simple in many respects. And I mean, the key things to know are simple. There is not a Tuesday morning meeting, an inter-industry meeting, where every Tuesday morning they get together and say, well, now, how can we become more boring? They don't have meetings like that. They don't need meetings like that. The fact is, if you spent 5 years as I had, it's pretty boring. Since we're reading things, I want to give you some sense of what an arcane world this is and how they're all, it's a whole other world. And I guess this would be true of other fields, certainly. Engineers who specialize in escalators or something have their own world. But listen to how actuaries talk. Okay. Now, what I'm about to read, you may think, is how I picture actuaries would talk, right? No. This is really something word for word that actuaries have said, and I quote. Actuaries, incidentally, are in many respects the finest people in the industry, and it's an industry of fine people. They're the scientists of the industry. And the actuaries said, quote, "The adjusted rates..." They were explaining how they got at these premium rates they established. "The adjusted rates are very simple. The adjusted rates were graduated by a Jenkins fifth difference modified osculatory interpolation formula with fourth differences at the endpoints set equal to zero," unquote. So the point is it can be a totally separate world. And to the extent that people never look into it, we have laws on the books of every state in this country that are appalling. And yet it's not a political issue. Nobody cares about insurance, so the laws stay there, and so on and so forth.
Well, I was speaking with Andrew Tobias, if you're just joining us, and we'll be talking a little bit later about some of the consumer concerns you may have when you're buying insurance, things to watch out for if you're buying auto insurance or homeowners insurance, life insurance. But first we're going to talk a little bit about the industry, which is one of the subjects he covers in his book, The Invisible Bankers. Now, you compare the insurance industry to the banking profession, and what's the comparison? Would you explain that for us?
Sure.
How is insurance like banking?
Well, let me do it very slowly because there are 1,900,000 people in this insurance industry, and about 1,800,000 of them have told me one way or another, "You idiot, don't you know insurance companies aren't banks?" Well, I do know that. I mean, after 5 years, I learned that I know that. But they're nonetheless analogies to some of us. Analogies are helpful in understanding things. First, even before the analogy to banks, an analogy to charity. Insurance is a wonderful thing, and I really mean that. Charity is also a wonderful thing. When you give money to a charity, you don't expect to get any of it back yourself, but you like to think that most of it is going to help whatever it is you're trying to help. If you gave money to a charity, gave $100 of your hard-earned money, and found out that only $42 of that $100 was going to save the whales or help the needy people, da-da-da-da, whatever it was, and that the other $58 of your $100 was going to fundraising expenses and to this expense and that expense and to a $185,000 salary for the head of the charity, you would say, hey, charity is still a wonderful thing, but I should find a different one. Okay, all right. In many of the, with insurance, insurance is like banking in several ways, and the main thing is insurance is a way that we collectively save for a rainy day. You can individually save for a rainy day by putting money in a savings bank. And when you do that, at the end of the year, you get your, if you put a dollar in, you get your dollar back plus interest. And still, in most years, certainly the savings banks that only pay 5% interest are able easily to make a profit. The ones, there's some problems with savings institutions these days having to pay 12 and 13% interest. But they give you your dollar back, they give you a nickel of interest back, and still they are able to pay all those salaries. They're able to pay for that big building. They're able to pay for the toasters they give away and for the advertising that they do. And they are able to pay for the security guard who stands there with a gun that he has never drawn in his life. And they pay for all of these things and they make a profit. Okay. Now, when we collectively pay insurance premiums for auto insurance, homeowners insurance, all this stuff, collectively, this is our national savings for all kinds of rainy days, for cars crashing and ships sinking and homes burning. Collectively, I mean, obviously some of us get nothing back. I hope we get, I mean, that's the good outcome. If you haven't had a crash, you don't get anything back. That's good, not bad. And some of us get much, much more back than we deposit, if you will, in the form of premiums. Because if you have paid $1,000 in homeowners premiums and your house burns down, you get this bonanza, namely $100,000 back. But collectively, how much of the dollar we put in do we get back? With a savings bank, as I say, you put in a dollar, you get back $1.05, more or less. When we collectively put our money in let's say, auto or homeowners insurance, we don't get back the dollar plus interest collectively. We don't get back the dollar without interest. We don't get back 90 cents. We don't get back 80 cents. We get back about 65 cents of each dollar in claims, but it's worse than that for a couple of reasons we'll talk about. I mean, if you're an honest policyholder, since you don't make fraudulent claims and padded claims, most policies are honest. Honest policyholders are paying for all the dishonest policyholders, who are in a distinct minority but still a very expensive group. All the arson that goes on for profit, you and I pay for. So if you're an honest policyholder, then you don't get back about 65 cents of each dollar that you put in. You get back closer to 50 cents. And there are even some other reasons, especially when you take your lawyer, your legal fees out of it. It comes out through the system, some of which isn't the fault of the insurance industry, other parts are, that in many cases you get back less than half the dollar. Okay. Well, I know insurance companies aren't banks. One critic said, you don't understand. Insurance companies have to pay claims. Sure, they have salaries and all that stuff, but they have to pay claims. As if, you know, this is this terrible burden they have, and by rights, if the world were really good, the way the insurance industry would work is they'd take in the money and they pay the sales commissions and all that stuff, but they wouldn't have to pay any claims at all. Okay, what kind of business would they take in our money? That would be their business. They take it in, that's all they do. They just take in the money. Of course they pay claims. That's the whole point. Do we have time for me just to one further amplification on this? The next obvious thing that I must say that some of the people in the industry have been very kind, and I've gotten some nice comments from industry people as well as the nasty comments. But from the nastier people, they say, well, the other thing you don't understand, banks don't take any risk. Okay, insurance companies are taking a risk. It's a very risky business, and so of course they should get a much higher return on their money, and they need more of the dollar. Well, to begin with, I'm not sure that the banks that have lent money to Braniff and to International Harvester and to Poland and so on and so forth don't take any risk. That's a whole separate issue. But is insurance – I mean, it sounds right. It sounds right that insurance is a very risky business. But is it? And I would contend, and I think it's pretty hard to argue against this, that by and large – there are a few exceptions. There are some insurance companies that specialize in very risky sorts of things and all that. But by and large –
insurance is much less a risky business than the highly profitable business of taking predictable risks. Okay? State Farm, which is a fine company, incidentally, State Farm Mutual, it is nonetheless a mutual company, in essence a nonprofit company, and it has a larger capital base, more accumulated profit, more of its policyholders' profit that it's kept in its bank account instead of refunding, has a larger capital base than the Bank of America, a larger capital base than Citicorp, the two largest banks in the country. So the risk to State Farm is so minimal because they insure so many people. For any given family, the risk of choking to death, which isn't something State Farm necessarily specializes in, but the risk of choking to death is a horrible freak accident. Okay, but for the nation as a whole, 250 Americans choke to death every month like clockwork. Okay, I mean, some months they'll be 238, another month 271, but it's not as though all of a sudden one month there are 9,000 and another month none. Well, it's an awful thing for a specific family. But if you're the Prudential and you insure tens of millions of people, you know how many people are going to choke to death. I mean, you know how many people are going to die. If you're State Farm, you know how many cars are going to crash. By and large, the business, especially the personal lines that I spend most of the time in the book talking about, the life and health and auto and homeowners, which is what most people are, you know, concerned with, this isn't a very risky business. This is the highly profitable business of taking predictable risks.
What happens with the other money on the dollar? You're saying that only maybe like half of the money that we collectively put in comes out in terms of claims. What happens to the other?
All right, we're talking using auto and homeowners again because that for this example. First of all, if it's 50 cents on the dollar, another 15 cents of the 50 we don't get back goes to pay for fraud and arson and padded claims. And there's a fellow who claimed his motorcycle was stolen and he had buried it in his backyard. There are people who are some foreign students who have helped to finance revolutions at home with accident rings, and they're very good at it. I mean, you could go on endlessly about fraud, but okay, part of it is that. And of course, this isn't the fault of the industry. One of the chapters is called "It's Almost Enough to Make You Feel Sorry for the for the insurance industry." Obviously, the next chapter is called "But Not Quite" because of the things that they do to us. Nonetheless, some of it goes to that. An awful lot of it goes to pay the salaries of 1,900,000 people employed by this industry. Now, it happens that the same service that we get if you restructured the industry and allowed competition really to function and allowed the free market to function and changed some very bad laws that are on the books, the same services could probably be provided with 1 million fewer people. That is to say that 1 out of every 100 Americans in the workforce is an ungainfully employed insurance employee. These are, I mean, it's not as though, you know, A through M are gainfully employed and N through Z are. These are nice people, hardworking people, and they're just as good as you and me. It's not their fault that the industry is structured so inefficiently. It's grown up this way over 100 years. But in fact, if you corrected the obstructions to competition and so on in the industry, in theory anyway, you could do the job with 1 million fewer people. We're paying for that, and it's real expensive.
What are the obstructions to competition?
Well, for example, there is a law in every state in this country forbidding the retailers of insurance, whom we call agents and brokers, forbidding them from cutting prices if they want to. If an agent or a broker wants to become the McDonald's of insurance with high volume, you know, and low prices, he's not allowed to. Now, I'm not saying any of them would want to, but they're not allowed to by law. There are laws in almost every state in the country forbidding the sale of group auto insurance. We have group life insurance and group health insurance, and these are very efficient, and they're inexpensive because they're efficient, and they're a wonderful thing. We don't have group auto insurance because the agents, and there are tens and tens of thousands of agents, and they're very powerful at the local state level where all this is regulated. The agents don't want it. The agents don't want to see, if you sell 1,500 auto policies every year and suddenly you're going to lose all those because it's going to be done when they sign up RCA all at once, you know, with all their employees. Anyway, group auto insurance is illegal in most states in this country, simply for political reasons. It's illegal in all but 3 states, illegal in all but New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, for savings banks to sell life insurance. Well, in Massachusetts, savings banks have been selling life insurance since Felix Frankfurter arranged the whole deal back in 1907, I think it was. I think it was Frankfurter. I may have the wrong Supreme Court justice. We can check during one of the commercials that we don't have on the show. But the thing about it is, in Massachusetts, it is by far the least expensive way to buy life insurance. Now, why are you in Pennsylvania not allowed to do that? Why in Ohio can't they have inexpensive life insurance sold by the savings banks? It's very simple. The life insurance industry doesn't want low-price competition. Okay. That gives you some sense of it. This is the one industry in the country that is exempt from federal regulation, and that includes it is exempt from federal antitrust statutes. Well, those are some of the structural reasons that you or I couldn't change tomorrow. What we can do is to learn to shop for insurance, learn the things that you do need to know, and that suddenly imposes that would solve half the problems, because that imposes a discipline no regulator can. That's called the discipline of the free market. And when it works, it's a wonderful thing. It doesn't work when people have no idea of how to tell a good value from a bad value.
So the competition doesn't function that well in the insurance industry because it's so hard life insurance to understand what you're getting? Is that
yes,
what you mean?
Yes, exactly. In life insurance particularly, which is a very big part of this, life insurance is a wonderful thing. But people, right now, I have parked back outside. I have a 1982 Ford Escort, okay? And it's blue. I mean, it's not just any, it's blue, and it's got an AM radio. I mean, we are talking AM radio that can receive stations from all across the state on a clear night, this radio in my car, okay? And it's got four wheels, and it's got carpeting underneath the seats, and I'm going to let anyone listening right now, I hope nobody takes me up on this, anyone listening right now can have this Ford Pinto, 1982, I'll autograph it, okay? $48,311. You see the phones lighting up? No. Okay. $38,1100. $26,000. Now, when you get right down to it, I don't know whether it should cost $5,500 or $6,500 or $85. What, you know exactly what it is, but you can be sure that if I were in the market to buy a car, I would very quickly get some sense of what it should cost. And I don't mind if, in fact, the price of a car like that is $6,500 at one dealership and someone pays $6,650 at another dealership. I don't care about that. But in the life insurance business and in other parts of the insurance business as well, people are forever buying Ford Pintos for $48,000, in essence. I mean, people paying two and three times as much as they should. I'm not saying all, you know, the average person, but in many cases, two and three times what they should for coverage that's available across the street. How many people listening right now know how much $20,000 of insurance, let's say, life insurance should cost for someone their age? I don't see the phones. You know, not that this isn't fair, but people don't know. How much should $100,000 cost? Nobody knows. If you don't know that, and if you're persuaded that you can't understand it, and indeed in most respects you can't, not that you're dumb or I'm dumb, it's that most of the life insurance morass is a morass, and you can't figure it out. There's only one way to do it where you can feel confident and know what it should cost. Well, if you can't tell a good value from a bad value, and if you can't shop intelligently, then the industry is under no pressure to provide a good value, or at least no great pressure. So that's the problem.
If you're just joining us, Andrew Tobias is my guest. We're talking about insurance, and it's the subject of his new book, which is called The Invisible Bankers. Well, before we get to some suggestions you have for buying each of the insurance types, you say that part of the reason why people buy insurance is to buy peace of mind. That makes sense to me. I mean, I have auto insurance, obviously, for my car, and I'm glad that should I get into an accident, which I certainly hope I don't, that you know, I'd right. I'd be covered for
sure.
It, and person would be covered for it. But are you implying that there's a false peace of mind, or that we're creating problems and then solving them?
You know, like any industry, there are wonderful elements and some elements that aren't so wonderful. Insurance is a terrific thing, and you definitely want to have insurance, and I have insurance for those risks which you or I can't afford to bear yourself. Okay, most families with young kids need life insurance. Many families with older kids need life insurance. If you have a car, heaven forfend, you should hit somebody. Some pedestrian without being covered with liability insurance, not just to protect yourself, but you owe it to whomever you might hit. If your house burns down, wouldn't it be awful if you didn't have adequate coverage? And a lot of people indeed don't have adequate coverage. So you definitely want insurance for the risks you can't afford to bear yourself. But you don't want to buy insurance for either the risks that you can't afford to bear, like a little dent in your fender or someone running into your hedge or someone stealing the stereo, and we can talk about this later, or, and here we get to the peace of mind, or for the risks that really aren't risks at all. And we the two that, I don't know if we'll have time to talk about both of them, but you know about clergyman malpractice insurance? I don't know how many clergymen are listening and how many of them, of those who are listening, have bought malpractice insurance. But there are at least two companies that sell malpractice insurance for clergymen. And you say to yourself, wait a second, how are you going to get a priest or a rabbi or somebody to buy malpractice insurance? And the fact is that sales were not exactly brisk in the early on because, you know, if people aren't worried, they're not going to get it hasn't even occurred to them to be worried about it. So the first thing you have to do is get them worried. And one way you do that is you have salesmen going around and you say, gee, this may never have occurred to you, but what happens, you know, if you tell somebody, you know, give them some advice and it turns out to be terrible advice and they sue you? You may not lose the suit, but just defending a suit, do you know how much it costs to defend a lawsuit? Well, a good salesman, given time, and the premiums are low, it's not really that big a deal, and I don't hold this out as one of the world's great evils. Nonetheless, it's kind of interesting to make the point. So you can get a certain number of clergymen stirred up about this. Well, along comes a much more creative and colorful salesman who told the following story, which got picked up on the AP wires and all over the country, and it became, you know, for a day, kind of the human interest story, about the woman who went to her clergyman, and she was having terrible marital problems. And they talked it over, and they talked it over, and finally the clergyman said, look, there's nothing else for it. You're going to have to leave your husband. Okay, this is reminiscent of the story we told at the beginning about the woman who shot her husband for not changing the flat tire, and it's totally different. But so, okay, she left her husband on the advice of not counsel in this case, but clergy. Okay, she left her husband, and the husband got so mad that he shot her. But he didn't kill her, and she recovered. And when she recovered, they patched up their differences, and then they sued the living daylights out of this clergyman. All right. Well, now you hear, if you are a clergyman, some of whom are, well, you hear you if you're a clergyman and you hear the story or you read it in the paper, you say, hey, maybe I should be worried about this after all. And naturally, it becomes easier to sell malpractice insurance to clergymen. It turns out, incidentally, that this event I just told you about never happened. The first one I told you in the beginning of the show happened about the flat tire and all that. This never happened, as far as anyone can tell, including the company that the salesman worked for. So as far as I know, it never happened. But it sure was a good story, wasn't it? I mean, if you're trying to sell malpractice insurance to clergymen, and there first you get them all nervous, and then you sell him the peace of mind. You don't have to worry anymore. In fact, you weren't worried 20 minutes ago till I came in and told you how worried you should be. But now that I've got you worried, I can calm you down. And where it does get really cruel and awful is when there are some fringe elements. And again, most of the industry is not like this, but it's a big industry, and so the fringe can be fairly large. The fringe elements who will sell health insurance policies and accident policies, among others, to elderly women living alone, for example, who never have visitors and who are terribly insecure and afraid of all kinds of health problems, and rightly afraid in that case. I mean, they're worried for a good reason, but the policies that they're sold are in many cases so exploitive and so bad and just duplicate other coverage, and so, you know, not all the policies will pay off, or the expected payout, far from being even 50 cents on the dollar on some of these policies, maybe 10 cents on the dollar. It's really awful, and the House of Representatives has had hearings into it and that sort of thing. It's a fringe, but it goes on all the time.
Are there types of insurance that you think only a neurotic really needs?
Well, one of my favorites is flight insurance. Again, not terribly important, but here is American Express, which makes more money from insurance than it does from credit cards or from traveler's checks. And American Express sends its cardholders a letter, and I've gotten it many times, saying, you know, dear whoever, boy, you really need to sign up for this plan we have, where every time you buy a ticket, if you charge on American Express, we're going to add $3 to the ticket, but you'll be covered with, it used to be $175, now it's $175,000, now it's $250,000 of life insurance. And this is vital coverage. Now, that's their word. That is a direct quote. I mean, some of the, I play around a little bit when I paraphrase their letter, but the vital coverage, they say it at two or three places, vital coverage that you really ought to have, And when you think about it, God, you know, with the planes, the way the 747s just keep one after another, keeps crashing, of course it's vital coverage. And in fact, we almost think that because here, this year, there have been all these headlines. The fact is, so far, a total of 78 people, as I may be off, but I think that's the right number, 78 people, tragically, have been killed in air accidents. We're talking about scheduled domestic flights, which is what is covered, or at least scheduled flights. 78 people, meanwhile, in the course of a year, there'll be 50,000 killed on the highways every year. The fact is, you are more likely to drown at home in your bathtub, literally, than to be killed on a scheduled domestic flight. So number one, it's not vital coverage. You're safer on that plane than you are crossing the street. You're safer on that plane than you are going to school. But number two, the other thing that they don't tell you is, what if there were a PS at the end of the letter? And they got you really interested. They really want to, you're all set to sign up. And then you read this PS, which of course there isn't. At the bottom of the letter, it says, P.S., you should know that for every dollar of premiums that you and your fellow American Express cardholders pay into a plan, into this plan, about a dime will be used for insurance, namely to pay benefits, and the other 90 cents is, I mean, we got to have something for our trouble, right? The other 90 cents, plus the interest we earn investing your premiums because, you know, I call them the invisible bankers because this is a big part of the business, not so much in flight insurance, but it's not only do we pay them premiums, but they earn interest investing our premiums, as they should. But that makes that all the more reason why we should get closer to a dollar back. Well, that's about the payout for flight insurance, 10 cents on the dollar. If you went to a casino and there were a slot machine with a sign that said, hello, for every dollar in nickels you put in me, I'm going to pay out a dime in winnings, I think that the casino should be allowed to have that slot machine and you should be allowed to play it. But in fact, if there were a sign like that, and I think there should be signs like that in the case of insurance so that people know the odds, a lot of people of their own free will would say, hey, I'm going to go to a different slot machine. You know, this is crazy. Well, there's lots you could say about flight insurance because it's fun, but it's not very important, so we probably should drop it.
Well, let's move along to the insurance premiums that most people hold. But before we do that, let me reintroduce you. Andrew Tobias is my guest. He's a contributing editor to Esquire and the author of several books on financial matters. His new one is called The Invisible Bankers, and it's subtitled Everything the Insurance Industry Never Wanted You to Know. Well, everyone or nearly everyone who has a car has auto insurance. Let's talk about some of the things to look for and some of the ways that even those of us with insurance phobia can sure. understand what we're signing up for. How do you figure out what you need in terms of deductibles for okay. auto insurance?
As it happens, there are really only two things that you really can do and should do as a consumer when it comes to auto insurance, because you can't change the laws. We mentioned, I mean, there's some terrible laws, and we could talk more about those. But given the current system, which is an awful system, there are really only two things you can do. One is you should shop around, and everybody knows it, and many people now do shop around. And I'm not saying you have to go with a company that has the lowest price, but you should at least know what's available. You'll save money if you deal with what's called a direct writer, a company that deals with you directly, not an independent insurance agent. But a lot of people are willing to pay extra for the independent insurance agent, the one that advertises on TV and says, look, you know, first of all, I represent several different companies, so I'll find you a good price. And in some cases, they do. Of course, one of the things that they're concerned with is who pays them the highest commission. They're human, and one study showed that 47% of insurance agents, the first thing they looked at in deciding what policy to get you is which one paid them the highest commission. But that still leaves 53%, and in any event, they might have looked at that first but still gotten you a good deal. So a lot of people are willing to pay what is often a little bit more for the independent agent because they have the feeling he can give good advice and he can help with claims. Number one is shop around, but number two is exactly what you asked, deductibles. The other place that you can affect affect this whole process and be a smart shopper is in having, for auto insurance and for homeowners for that matter as well, the highest deductible that you can comfortably afford for five reasons, okay? The first reason is if you have a high deductible, let's say $500 in your car and $1,000 on your home instead of $50 or $100 deductible or even $250. If you have a high deductible, the first thing is your premiums, of course, are lower. Maybe not as much lower as they should be, actuarially speaking, because the insurance industry is not really eager to have you buy less insurance, which is what you're doing when you have a high deductible. Nonetheless, every year your insurance premiums are lower. Number two, if you do have a loss, let's say you have an $1,100 loss, all but $100 of an unreimbursed loss, of an uninsured loss, is deductible as a perfectly legitimate tax deduction. And if you itemize your deductions, and even if you didn't, you might if you had a $1,000 extra deduction. If you itemize your deductions and you're in the 40 or 50% tax bracket on that last few dollars you earn between the federal tax and the Pennsylvania income tax, well, then 40 or 50% of the loss, all but $100 of it, 40 or 50% of that is paid for automatically, free, in the form of lower taxes. You can't take that deduction if you are insured, if you are reimbursed by your insurance. So number one, your premiums are lower. Number two, to a certain extent, a lot of us already have 40 or 50% coverage free for nothing if we don't buy insurance. Number three, how many people listening right now are paying for the right to make small claims but not making them if they have them because they're afraid that if they do, their rates will be raised or their policies won't be renewed? Okay, and in many cases, they're smart not to make those claims because it can cost you much more over the long run to make the claim than not to make the claim. So there's no point in paying for the right to make a little claim if you're not going to make it. Four, and I'm sorry to have so many reasons, but it's important, so I try to make the strongest case I can. Number four, you know, if you have a dented fender and it's insured, then you go, it's cost $400, right, or whatever, $400. Now, if it were your money, what you really might opt to do, you might go the $400 route. A lot of people would, but a lot of other people, if it were their money, you know what they'd really do? Of course, they'd bang out the bump a little bit. Maybe they'd spray paint it to make sure that it doesn't rust, and you can tell that I don't know anything about automobiles from the way I'm describing this, but there are ways, if you don't want the car to look perfect, to do it for a lot less, maybe for $30 instead of $400. If it's insured, you automatically go the $400 route. If it were your money, you might go the $30 route. Of course, collectively, it is our money. Collectively, we are paying the $400, all of us. It's all reflected in the rates. And one of the things this does is it gives us the wrong signals. It sends out the wrong economic signals because for those people who would have preferred to go the $30 route instead of the $400 and have a not quite as attractive car, well, they're wasting $370 that they might have wanted to spend it another way. So the point is, if you do self-insure that first $500 or even more, if your car isn't all that new, you may want to skip collision insurance altogether. You want liability, but you may want to skip collision insurance, which is the highest deductible of all. Finally, the fifth reason isn't a selfish reason. These other four reasons are more or less selfish reasons. The fifth reason is, if people took high deductibles, within reason, the $500,000 I'm talking about 3/4 of all the millions of claims that are submitted every year, and each one is a potential battle, and each one is either we hate the insurance company because they were too slow or too niggardly in how they paid, or they hate us because they think we're cheating them. 3/4 of these things would be wiped off the books. And grown men and women would not be spending hours over who should pay for a windshield that was cracked by a pebble. My dad runs an ad agency in New York. It's not an enormous company, but they have, you know, some good money in the bank, and it's a big company, all that sort of thing. And one of their cars had a pebble break the windshield, and there you have grown people calling the insurance agency to talk to other grown people at the insurance company to, is it covered? Isn't it covered? It's $175, you know, and what kind of forms we have to fill out and all this stuff. Here's a company that if one of their clients went broke, they could be left on the hook for $50,000 in unpaid ad bills. They're not insured for that. But if there's a $175 crack in a windshield, that risk they are paying handsomely to have someone else bear. It's crazy. So deductibles should be much higher. AT&T is insured for any fire loss. Used to be over $300,000. They finally decided this is ridiculous, so they raised it to $2.5 million. So AT&T has a $2.5 million deductible on its fire insurance. $2.5 million to AT&T is like $12.50 to someone earning $25,000 a year. So this applies to corporations as well as individuals.
With the deductible, I think the psychology behind getting a low deductible is that, well, say something happens. Say you're in an accident and your car is totaled. You're not only going to have to suffer through all that, but you've bought all this insurance. And on top of all the money you're spending for the insurance, now you're going to have to lay out $500 because you've got such a because that's the deductible that you have. And, you know, it's a gamble. But if you lose the gamble, you've really lost a lot.
Yeah. Well, there are you know, I would never suggest that people shouldn't be allowed to buy full coverage, for example, or whatever deductible they want. And for those who don't itemize their tax deductions, you don't automatically have the government paying for 30 or 40 or 50% of it. So I certainly would never say people can't do what is, I think, logically in their interest. If they want to act a little bit illogically, they have every right to do it.
Let's move on to life insurance. Who do you think should have life insurance? Who would life insurance really benefit?
Life insurance is basically for people who have dependents who would suffer financially if they died and who care enough that they want to protect those dependents. And that an awful lot of people fit into that category. I'll tell you some people who don't fit into that category. Kids. When parents buy life insurance on the lives of their children, it's a waste of money. Because if the child dies, heaven forfend, the family's expenses go down after the initial shock of the funeral. They don't go up. Financially speaking, it improves the budget. It doesn't hurt it. That money should go to increase the coverage on the breadwinner, on the parents, not on the children. College kids are forever, you know, senior year in college, it's part of the ritual. You know, you have to sign up for a mortar board and all these different things. And one of the things that you very often get, in addition to your class ring, is a 3-hour assault from an insurance agent who is going to sell you the policy. And believe me, he says, if you start now, while you're young, it's so much less expensive. And that's true, because you're paying that many more years and for all kinds of reasons. The fact is, college kids, unless they have dependents, college kids don't need life insurance. Really rich people don't need life insurance, with there are some exceptions for tax reasons and some complications. But basically, if you died and your dependents would have millions of dollars or enough, whatever it is, you don't need insurance on top of that. For the people who do need insurance, which is an awful lot of people, the problem is that very few, not very few, but so many, buy the wrong kind and get less than they could and pay more for it than they should.
Well, there's two different kinds, whole life and term. Maybe you could just summarize the differences for us.
It's very simple. There really are only two kinds of life insurance, even though there are millions of names. Everybody has a different plan. One kind is term insurance. And that really, that's insurance. Term insurance is plain, pure, simple, vanilla insurance. If you die while the policy is in force, they pay whatever, you know, $100,000 or whatever the policy was for. And because in your 20s and your 30s and your 40s and even your 50s, you're not likely to die, it's very inexpensive. Anyone listening right now in good health, particularly non-smokers, but basically anyone in normal good health, under 40, can buy $100,000 of term insurance, life insurance, for between $150 and $250 a year, period. All right, now if you're 39, I mean, of course, as you get older, it goes up. So if you're near the top of that range and you're paying $270 or $280 instead of $250 or something, okay. Or if you're really shopped around and got a good deal at $210, fine. But it's that simple, $150 to $250 a year at those ages. I have a table in the book for the other ages because it begins to go up real fast. By age 50, we're talking about $600 a year. But still, for a 50-year-old, isn't so much to pay for $100,000 of coverage. By age 60 and 70 and 80, term insurance gets enormously expensive because you really might die. But by age 60, 70, and 80, the kids have grown up. And by age 60, 70, and 80, maybe the mortgage has been paid off. And by ages 60, 70, and 80, you may have saved up some money for retirement. Okay, number one, the first kind of insurance is term insurance. All of the other kinds of insurance, basically whole life insurance, but there are other names for it, permanent insurance, ordinary insurance, variable life, even the new universal life, which is a step in the right direction. But all of these other things are really two things. They're term insurance, like we just talked about, plain, simple life insurance, plus a savings plan. Okay, and the reason that the $100,000 we talked about that might have been $200 a year for a 35-year-old term insurance route, the reason it's $1,200 a year in the whole life route is because that $1,000 difference basically goes to fund a savings plan, which incidentally allows the policy never to go higher. It starts out much, much higher than term insurance, but it stays level for the whole of life. Well, savings is great. I believe in savings plans, and I believe in saving money. But the problem with the savings plan in whole life, the first problem is they don't tell you the rate of interest. Imagine going to a savings bank or a money market fund or something, and they said, hey, you know, we buy a piece of our rock or something, and we can't tell you what rate of interest it's going to be, but trust us. Okay, well, so that's second problem is, if you could figure it out, which you can't, if you could figure it out, you would be appalled in many cases to see how low this, it is tax-free, but how low this tax-free rate of interest is. Now, there are some, especially for people, there are some plans that are beginning to pay what might someday be considered competitive interest, but you can't tell the good plans from the bad plans anyway. So the simplest thing for most people to do, and the right thing for them to do, is to buy, when they want life insurance, when they need life insurance, is to buy plain, pure, simple life insurance where they understand what they're getting and what they're paying. $100,000 of coverage, you're 35, $200 a year. Okay? Once you know that, if somebody comes around and says, I have a deal for you, it's $100,000 of insurance, and it's only $46.81 a month, plus we pay for one free ride to the airport, and we throw in, this signed autograph picture from Andy Warhol. I mean, it gets so complicated, you can't begin to know what it is, but $46 a month, that's $500 a year. You can get insurance for $200 a year. Why pay $500 when you can pay $200? With term insurance, you can make a confident decision. You know what it should cost, and that's all you pay. Then, with all the money you save by going the inexpensive term insurance route, that money, for example, can be used in an individual retirement account, which is a wonderful disciplined savings vehicle, which is now 1982, is finally everyone can set up, or just about anyone who has earnings can set up an individual retirement account. A great way to save for retirement, which I believe in. I'm not saying you shouldn't save. I'm not saying it's not important. Capital formation is terribly important to the country, all these things. But with an IRA, which has its own tax advantages, very strong tax advantages, and its own discipline, every April 15th, people say, gee, you mean if I had really just done that, put the $2,000 away like the ads say, I would have saved $800 on my taxes or $1,000 on my taxes? People are signing up for these plans by the millions because of the discipline of the IRA. Well, that's the way most families should go. Buy term insurance inexpensively where you know what you're getting and you can't be fleeced, and then use the money you save to save for your retirement in some way that you really understand what you're getting.
Would it be too personal to ask you what insurance you have?
No. I used to, when I had a car, which I always used to have, and I don't now, but when I had a car, I had maximum coverage on liability, or at least the maximum I could afford, but also the maximum deductible. On my homeowner's insurance, I have, I try each year, I say, can I have a higher deductible? And there are some companies that will do it on a percentage basis, which makes sense. Anyone listening has like a $500,000 home, you might deal with a company that will give you a 5% deductible. Well, for all intents and purposes, that means you're insuring just for the house burning down or some major accident. On my life insurance, I don't need any. But I have some because for 5 years working on the book and all that stuff, I'm intrigued, and it's so inexpensive. I have about $200,000 of term insurance that cost me very little at my age, like $400, $300, $400 a year. And at some point, I'll let it lapse. But I know, I mean, it's a conscious decision. I know I don't need it. And as long as people consciously know they don't need it and want it, fine. And I know I'm not paying too much for it. So that's pretty much what I have. Some people...
Health insurance?
Well, sure. Blue Cross is terrific, and a major medical on top of that. And we can talk about all those fields. If you do have some assets to protect, it makes sense to have an umbrella policy, which is an umbrella liability policy. Your homeowner's policy will automatically cover you, you know, if someone slips and falls on your... there are cases, one of the cases of a fellow who, they had this guest room on the second floor, and it overlooked a little wading pond, a little shallow pond, and one of the guests got a little drunk, and it was late at night, and figured, oh, great, a swimming pool right underneath my balcony, and they dove in, you know, 2 feet of water and all that sort of, you need liability insurance for that sort of thing, and the typical homeowner's policy will be for $25,000 of coverage, liability insurance, but for another $4, at least in my case, it goes up to $100,000. So I take the $100,000. But what you may want on top of that is what's called an umbrella policy if you're a doctor or a lawyer or someone with substantial assets, so that you're covered up to maybe $1 million. Because if someone does dive into your into your bathtub or something like that, it could be a big lawsuit.
Andrew Tobias is my guest. He's a contributing editor to Esquire and a financial writer. His new book on the insurance industry is called The Invisible Bankers. So what are your favorite insurance commercials that are currently on the air, or ones from the last few years?
Well, I mean, naturally the Prudential ones about people going off to heaven are kind of fun. And my favorite awful – there's my favorite ad because it's so awful, a very great – a wonderful ad and so diabolically deceptive and awful is a full page in Money Magazine. And, you know, people see this in Money Magazine, which is a good magazine, and they figure, hey – you know, it's got to be more or less on the level. And there was a picture of a young teenage girl dancing with some very Latin-looking, older, suave, whatever, and it said the headline was something like, "You for $46.25, you can give your daughter a 3 tango lessons with Mr. Kenneth, or whatever, you know, or with actually with Mr. whatever would have been Mr. Amici or something like that, or a $10,000 estate." Well, I mean, any responsible father, or mother for that matter, but you can just see the father with his daughter and all that. Anyone paging through that, it takes a pipe out of his mouth, writes out the check for $46. The two things that the ad doesn't tell you are, first, of course, that your daughter doesn't need $10,000 of life insurance. And second thing is that, in fact, of the $46 that you paid, about 6 cents of each dollar, about 6% at her age and with the actuarial expectations and so on, 6 cents of each dollar would be used to pay death benefits for 17-year-old girls who really died. And the other 94 cents went to pay for the ad and went to pay for, you know, all to get you worried about your daughter and the whole thing. But it was a brilliant ad, and I don't know how much business it pulled in, but it pulled some in.
There's an old... I don't know if it's a joke, it's just a stereotype that if you're at a dinner party and you're sitting next to someone who's in the insurance business, they'll try to sell you insurance even though it's a party and everyone's committed to not pushing their thing on the person next to them. When you go to a party and you're next to someone in the insurance industry, what are they going to say to you now that you've written this book?
Well, you know, my most vocal critics come from especially life insurance salesmen who haven't read it. There are certainly vocal critics who read the book, but I was on a call-in show in Dallas, and first I got this very gruff sounding call. I figured, oh boy, I'm in trouble now. And I said, "Mr. Tobias, I read your book about a month and a half ago, oh God, I know what I'm in for." And he said, and it got me to reorganize my thinking about my auto insurance and this and that. I got 3 cars and my life insurance. I'm saving $700 a year. Wow, this is great. The next call came from a woman with the sweetest voice, and I said, "This is too good to be true." 2 really nice calls in a row, and she said, "Mr. Tobias, I just want you to know, I saw you on the Phil Donahue show, and you're a total idiot. I mean, you are the worst," and on and on. And I said, "Now, I don't want to. I have 2 questions to ask, and I don't mean that they negate your point. You may well be right, but I'm just curious. Are you, by any chance, a life insurance salesperson?" And she said she was. And I said, "Am I right in assuming you haven't read the book that you think is so terrible?" And she said, "No, she hadn't read it." And she's not going to either, you know. She's not. And I said, "Okay. I mean, you may still be right. That doesn't prove you're wrong. But we've had, I showed you before we started, the actuarial review. Does everybody get a copy of the actuarial review? No. But, I mean, I think they have a circulation of 1,600. I'm thrilled, of course, when the New York Times or somebody says something nice about the book. But far more important to me is when the actuarial review says that I've done my homework and that, you know, that it's worth reading and all that, because you can certainly argue that I'm wrong about some of the opinions. But most of the insurance people who read it carefully at least believe that it was done in good faith. Not all, but most of them do.
For the WUHY listeners who've been with us for the past hour, they're probably sitting on the edge of their chairs right now, knowing that the cliffhanger we began this with is about to be resolved. So for our listeners who weren't with us at the beginning of the hour, let me ask you to sum up the claim and then give us the answer. Did she collect?
A woman killed her husband because he refused to change a flat tire on the turnpike. And the question is, and the man had $22,000 in life insurance. Does she collect? She killed her husband. And the answer is, ordinarily not. You're not supposed to kill your husband. And if you kill your husband, ladies listening, and vice versa, man, don't kill your wife, because ordinarily you will be deprived not only of your liberty, but of your life insurance benefits. However, this woman was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Because, I mean, the jury just, she killed her husband for not changing a flat tire. She's got to be crazy. They found her not guilty for it. So she went to jail or, you know, a psychiatric prison or something like that. But she nonetheless collected $22,000 because technically she was not guilty. So she collected.
What's the moral of the story?
The moral of the story is between that and the fantasy sex hangings and the Japanese man killed by a flying foot and all these things we didn't get a chance to talk about, the moral of the story is what kept me sane for the 5 years of writing this thing and what I hope will get people through the weekend enjoying it is there is tons of – every one of these things is a National Enquirer headline. There is a woman whose belly button was misplaced in plastic surgery. She collected $873,000. You don't need to know about that to buy insurance, but if you don't have that stuff, if you don't have the anesthesiologist – I mean, this man is crucial to my book. Do we have the anesthesiologist who is accused of sexually abusing scores of his patients while they were undergoing surgery. Okay, well, there's a curtain that separates the anesthesiologist from the rest of the operating team. He ties into medical malpractice. If you don't have these people, then insurance is boring and dull and complicated, and no one finds anything about it, and they wind up paying for the rest of their life. You know, because you only have to learn it once. You don't have to learn it every year. Once you get the basics of it, and then you know for the rest of your life more or less how not to get taken and how to save.